Good morning, Mr. Chief Justice. John Abramczyk appearing today for Appalese. With me at council table, it's my pleasure to introduce Mr. Andrew Fry from the Mayor Brown firm and his colleague, Hannah Shen Wong. Also with me is Mr. James Bennett from the Dowd Bennett firm of Minnesota. St. Louis, Missouri.
Good morning, may it please the court. I'd like to make some introductions on our side. With me from my firm is Bradley Ehrenstam, and from the Kellogg, Huber, Hansen, Todd, Evans, and Feigl firm in Washington, D.C., Scott Attaway, Scott Angstreich, and David Frederick. And with the court's permission, Mr. Frederick will be making the argument today.
Welcome.
Thank you, Chief Justice Steele, and may it please the court. The Delaware General Assembly has provided that the policy of the Limited Liability Company Act is, quote, to give maximum effect to the principle of freedom of contract and to the enforceability of limited liability company agreements. The court below, however, applied the statute of frauds to foreclose Brian Olson from proving the existence of a contract to receive an earnout over a period of 6 years for the equity he had helped to build in the Viking hedge fund. The court compounded that error by holding that an earlier oral agreement precluded Olson from receiving the protection of the LLC Act and obtaining fair value for his interest in the enterprise he helped to create. For three reasons, the judgment below should be reversed and the case remanded for a new trial. First, the statute of frauds nullification of some LLC agreements cannot be reconciled with the General Assembly's directive to give maximum effect to freedom of contract and the enforceability of LLC agreements. Second, even if the statute of frauds does apply, the lower court used the wrong standard for determining whether the multiple writings exception is satisfied.
Why did you use the phrase the statute of frauds nullifies some oral LLC agreements?
As the court below held, those oral agreements that could be satisfied within 1 year would not fall afoul of the statute of frauds. So what the court did was it gave only partial effect to the enforceability of LLC agreements. It found that if there were oral agreements that could be satisfied within the 1 year period of the statute of frauds did not preclude evidence that would lead to the enforceability of such agreements.
Did you raise the issue with the Vice Chancellor about whether Section 18-1017 is dispositive in its own right? It says, as I understand it, that LLC agreements may be written, oral, or implied.
We did.
Why isn't that the end of the case?
It should be, Your Honor, because the oral agreement here, as evidenced by the unsigned writing, was sufficient to establish the earnout that Mr. Olson claims. That was raised before the Vice Chancellor. The Vice Chancellor, however, held that the statute of frauds precluded the evidence of the oral agreement because the earnout, as it had been agreed to among the founders, extended beyond the 1 year period prescribed in the statute of frauds. And based on that error, Mr. Olson was denied the opportunity even to prove a breach of contract claim. That claim was removed from the case prior to trial, and we submit that was reversible error. There should be a trial on the contract for the earnout of the equity that Mr. Olson helped to create in the Viking hedge fund. With respect to the second point on the multiple writings exception, and let me get the three points out that I'd like to make. The second is the court apply too stringent a requirement, even assuming the statute of frauds applies. And third, the case should be remanded because not only did Mr. Olson not receive a trial on his breach of contract claim, but the error on the statute of frauds ruling infected the evidence that would lead to adequate proof with respect to the statutory fair value claim. With respect to the statute of frauds, we think that the case begins and ends on the policy of enforceability for LLC agreements being given maximum effect. The legislature made that very clear, and this is a statute, Your Honors, that has been followed by 22 other states. There are no cases that we have found in which the interplay between the statute of frauds and the maximum effect language has been construed. So this is a case of first impression. And what the statutory language, by using the word maximum effect, intends to incorporate a concept of as much as possible. That's the ordinary and plain meaning of maximum. By holding that some oral agreements would be subject to the statute of frauds, the Vice Chancellor only gave partial effect to the oral agreements that the General Assembly has provided for with respect to limited liability company agreements. And the lower court's holding creates uncertainty among LLC members as to which of their agreements will be upheld. As even the Vice Chancellor acknowledged, had the founders here arranged for their affairs to be winded up upon the termination of one of the founders within 1 year, the exact same earn-out could have been paid. But the founders had a different notion, and that was to allow the remaining founders to continue using the Viking Hedge Fund as a means of creating value that could pay out the earn-out that had been obtained over a period of time by one of the founders. This was a very special arrangement that was intended to give the remaining founders an opportunity to use their ongoing enterprise to remain viable while they paid out the equity owed to the terminated member. With respect to the second point, the multiple writings exception was also erroneously handled by the Vice Chancellor. The legal standard and the leading case is by the case of Crabtree v. Elizabeth Arden Sales Corp. From the New York Court of Appeals. And that case, in effect, has been adopted in the Restatement of Contracts, Sections 131 and 132. The standards, as applied in those restatement provision, provides that if there is reasonable identification of the subject matter that is sufficient to show that a contract with respect to the matters have been made, then, and thirdly, that there is reasonable certainty of the essential terms, then multiple writings can establish that there was a memorandum of agreement. Now, importantly, in Crabtree and in Section 132 of the restatement, the provision is made for an unsigned writing to establish the key or essential terms that are issued, so long as a signed writing was sufficient to establish that an agreement had been made. And if I could point the court to the appendix that we've provided, page A128, the liquidation agreement that was established by the founders after 9/11 as a means of ensuring the orderly liquidation of the enterprise was signed by all three founders. It was signed by all three founders in multiple capacities, including as managing director and operating committee member of Viking Global Founders, LLC. This is at page A130, where Mr. Halverson made that signature. And on page A128, in both paragraphs 1 and 2, there are multiple references to the VG Founders Agreement, thereby establishing that these founders, in fact, had a written operating agreement for the founders, LLC. Importantly, the other side never gives a reason why the founders would have created an LLC for just the founders. And yet it is clear from the record that several hundred million dollars was paid to the founders according to the equity percentages set out in the founders' agreement, including in excess of $100 million through the founders' entity itself. So the unsigned founders' agreement is the best evidence of what the operating agreement of the LLC was. Now, my third point is that a remand under the right legal standard is required here. First, the breach of contract claim that Mr. Olson brought was never tried. And it was not tried because of the court's erroneous holding with respect to the statute of frauds. A new trial for that claim, therefore, is required. Secondly, the issue that the defendants, the appellees here, raise of harmless error is incorrect because the best evidence constituting the agreement and the existence of the agreement, of the unsigned founders agreement, was the signed liquidation agreement. Yet nowhere in the 2009 post-trial opinion is the liquidation agreement referenced. Why? Because the appellees told the vice chancellor, because you have already ruled on the statute of frauds question as a matter of enforceability, the evidence that Mr. Olson seeks to adduce about the existence of an agreement for the earnout shouldn't be considered. And that is why, in the 2009 opinion by the vice chancellor, there's no reference to the liquidation agreement. Yet I would submit, if you look at the agreement on the face of its terms, the references to the VG Founders Agreement as the operating agreement of the Founders LLC could not be plainer.
So when you argue that the ruling on the statute of frauds fatally infected the evidence that was introduced on the claims other than the contract claim, what that boils down to is the court didn't consider the agreement that you, the liquidation agreement, is that correct?
The liquidation agreement, that's correct, Your Honor.
Is that the argument?
Yes. The argument is that the liquidation agreement is a signed writing that establishes that all three signatories, the three founders of the Viking Founders LLC, had an operating agreement for Viking Founders. And the only agreement that exists is the unsigned Viking Founders LLC agreement, through which, as a matter of custom and practice, hundreds of millions of dollars had been distributed through that entity to the founders themselves, according to the equity percentages that had been laid out in that agreement. By not giving credence to that, what the vice chancellor did hold was that the statutory fair value provision in the Delaware Code could not be established because there was contrary oral evidence of the existence of an agreement that had been made, according to the vice chancellor, before these Viking entities had been established. And so the vice chancellor, to put this in chronology, said that an oral arrangement that had been agreed to in February 1999 concerning percentages of payouts would govern all of the Viking entities. Our position is that subsequent to that, the founders decided to make a different arrangement with respect to their equity. And the concept that there is no equity in this hedge fund.
But didn't the court consider that argument and reject it as a matter of fact, and came up in its opinion with multiple reasons why that argument was not supported by the evidence?
It did so after excluding, on the basis of the statute of frauds, the best evidence to the contrary.
Well, that argument presupposes that if that piece of paper had been before the court in the trial, that the findings of fact would have been totally different from what they were. How do you get there?
Well, we get there by pointing to the agreement itself, Justice Jacobs, which is the best evidence that, in fact, the founders had multiple LLC agreements. They signed each signature line, and this is on A30, A130, and A31. Each of the founders was signing in multiple capacities as operating committee members of these various LLCs. The references to the founders LLC could not be plainer from paragraphs 1 and 2 of the letter agreement, and yet that evidence was not even mentioned in the opinion. And the reason we submit it's not mentioned is because the other side told the vice chancellor, you've already ruled on the statute of frauds that the argument Mr. Olson is making with respect to his contract is precluded by the statute of frauds. Therefore, that evidence is not permissible to negate our argument that there was a preceding oral agreement to negate the fair value provision of the statute. So we've got these oral agreements here, Your Honor, that end up working in a very pernicious way. And as the leading state with respect to corporation law, in particular with respect to the smaller corporate entities like LLCs, it's particularly important for this court to announce a clear rule that would not lead to such pernicious results. All we are asking for here is an opportunity to prove at trial that with all of this evidence being considered together, a valid contract was made. We're not asking for judgment as a matter of law. We're asking for a fair opportunity to prove that without having the statute of frauds operate in an anachronistic and pernicious way to negate the oral operating agreements under which the founders operated. And that's true. There was evidence of their pay stubs being paid through the founders' entity. They offer no reason why founders would have been set up as an entity. As it turns out, there were equity percentages that at the end of each year, the founders alone would receive money as cap and compensation for the actual work they did in one column and equity payout in a different column. And that evidence also was not referenced by the vice chancellor because that went to the evidence of the existence of an operating agreement for VG founders. Based on that principle, it would be unusual to find that a statute of frauds that was intended to eliminate the opportunity of fraud, or at least to restrict it as an evidentiary matter, would be used as a sword here to make an unsigned writing, non-existent evidence, so that the court would then credit a prior oral agreement over which there was dispute. And that kind of result is not one that this court should countenance. If there are no further questions, I'd like to save the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you.
May it please the court. I'd like to thank you first for your courtesy in allowing me to appear today. And I'd like to start with first things first. We think it's quite clear that the statute of frauds ruling made no difference to the outcome of the case. If the statute of frauds had been found inapplicable, it's quite clear from the vice chancellor's opinion that the case would have turned out exactly the same way. Now, this is true because even with the statute of frauds, the vice chancellor had to determine whether there was an agreement to the earnout or not. And that's because of the fair value statute and the promissory estoppel claims. I just want to take a minute to explain how the fair value statute operates and produces this result. Under the fair value statute, a departing partner is entitled to the fair value of their interest in the partnership unless there is a contrary agreement. So the question is, was there a contrary agreement? And if so, was that contrary agreement ever superseded? Now, the vice chancellor found that there was an oral agreement to the core principles under which the Viking Fund would operate in February of 1999. And Mr. Olson himself admitted that in his testimony. So this unfairness of enforcing the oral agreement, which of course is not subject to the statute of frauds and is enforceable under the LLC Act, is a sham argument.
If I can just interrupt you at this point.
Yes, of course.
Related to this issue is a question that your learned colleague on the other side asked, which is, why was Founders ever set up as a separate entity if not if there were not a modification of the cap comp oral agreement?
Well, the answer to that is not totally clear, but there was testimony by Mr. Halverson that it was set up, that there were two purposes which in his mind were separate. One was to handle the income stream that was coming to the founders, and by running it through the founders' entity, it would be confidential what the division was among the founders. The second, which he said was separate in his mind and never agreed to, was the earnout. So there was a purpose to it. So the question, once once the vice chancellor found that there had been an initial agreement that a departing partner would take only their capital account and their compensation for the work they had done prior to departure, the next question was whether that was superseded by the earnout, which Mr. Olson claimed existed, or by some other promise that there would be some kind of equity or capital payout beyond cap and comp. If that was the case, even if the contract was unenforceable, the fair value provision of the statute would be applicable. So the vice chancellor had to find whether there was an agreement that superseded the limitation to cap and comp, as we've referred to it during the case. Now, in considering this, he did not exclude a single piece of evidence or limit the argument in any way on account of the statute of frauds ruling. And he then wrote a lengthy opinion in which he explained in detail why he found that there was never any agreement. And I call the court's attention to the Homestore case, which was cited in our brief, which is a case in which the laches defense was excluded on summary judgment. The appellant appealed claiming it was error, and this court held that because unclean hands was tried and decided against the appellant, and it necessarily followed that the decision on the laches defense didn't make any difference. It's the same situation here. The decision on the statute of frauds didn't make any difference to the outcome of the case. Well, the court found that I don't need to repeat its opinion. Substantial evidence, including the credibility of the witnesses, the inclusion of the cap and comp provision in every signed written agreement, Olson's repeated assurances to Mr. Cahill and to the analysts that when the founding partner left, they would get only cap and comp and no more. And this was very important to the successful operation of the fund, because all of the income that they earned was being distributed. None of it was being reserved to fund a possible payout afterwards. Now, Mr. Olson does not challenge the sufficiency of the evidence to support the vice chancellor's finding, as he told you today. He does not challenge any evidentiary ruling. I think he cannot point to any place where any evidence was excluded that bore on the question whether there was an agreement.
Well, that's where I'm confused. You're telling us that the vice chancellor didn't exclude or fail to consider any evidence. The other side argues that the vice chancellor did exclude and failed to consider a vital piece of evidence. It would appear that the bona fides, one way or the other, of that argument should be determinable from the record.
It is determinable from the record. First of all, evidence was introduced about the liquidation agreement. Extensive argument was made about the liquidation agreement, and of perhaps most significance during the post-trial argument, and I'm citing to page 57 to 58 of the transcript of the post-trial argument. I'm not sure that it's in any appendix. Counsel for Viking is arguing about why you could infer from the evidence that there was no agreement, and the vice chancellor asks, what about the liquidation agreement? So clearly, and this was after counsel for Olson had argued about the liquidation agreement during his argument. So the liquidation agreement clearly was before the vice chancellor. The case that they cite, the Barrow case, is a case where evidence was actually excluded in a jury trial and never heard by the jury, and the court found that the exclusion was both erroneous and prejudicial and reversed. That is nothing like this case. In fact, the rule, I believe, in this court and in any court that I've ever heard of is that the opinion of the lower court does not have to discuss every piece of evidence that's advanced by the other side. And in a case called Metropolitan Mutual Fire Insurance, 220 Atlantic 2nd at 780, the court held that it, quote, must assume that the trial judge considered and evaluated all the admitted evidence. The evidence of the liquidation agreement was admitted. The court must assume that it was considered. If you don't assume that it was considered, you're opening an incredible Pandora's box, because every case in which the trial judge or the vice chancellor writing an opinion does not explicitly address every piece of evidence is a case that you would have to reverse. Now, I might add that even if Mr. Frederick were right that the vice chancellor had somehow excluded from his consideration the liquidation agreement, I think it would probably have been harmless error in this case. After all, the vice chancellor found that the evidence was overwhelming, this is his word, not mine, that there never was any agreement to supersede the cap and comp agreement. And the liquidation agreement itself doesn't have a lot of probative value in our opinion. And I'd like to read to the court a brief passage from the vice chancellor's opinion on the statute of frauds issue where he discusses the liquidation agreement. And he says, the reference to limited liability company agreement, quotes, in the liquidation agreement, I add, is a generic phrase, and there is no additional information such as a date or distinguishing terms to aid in determining whether the liquidation agreement refers to the unsigned founder's long-form document or an oral operating agreement for founders. So the use of the term limited liability company agreement of VG founders is essentially boilerplate. You can imagine, I think, quite readily that the liquidation agreement would have read exactly the same way if there never was a draft unsigned agreement for founders, but simply the oral agreement that was made at the outset of the formation of Viking. So unless there are any further questions on that point, I'll move on to discussing the statute of frauds with the caveat that none of this discussion that follows, in our opinion, makes any difference to the judgment that you ought to render. And let me first respond to the Chief Justice's question about the effect of Section 107, which allows oral agreements. In our view, that does nothing more than make LLC agreements in that respect like any other contract. In this state, as in any state, if the statute of frauds doesn't apply, you can have an oral contract. I think it's quite clear that, well, let me back up. When the legislature originally adopted the LLC Act, it required written agreements, LLC agreements. It did not allow oral LLC agreements. The maximum effect language on which appellant relies was contained in that original provision. So it's clear that at the time the Act was initially enacted in 1992, the legislature did not think that maximum effect meant that you had anything to do with the formation of the contract. In 1995, they decided that they should allow oral agreements. But of course, that simply applies the rule that generally applies to all contracts. Oral agreements are allowed, except to the extent the statute of frauds renders them unenforceable in particular circumstances. Now, Mr. Frederick may not like the way the statute of frauds operates, that it allows some oral agreements and disallows other oral agreements, but that's not a matter for this court. That's a legislative policy matter. And that is true not just for LLC agreements, but for any contract that's subject to the statute of frauds. In any case, you may have an oral agreement that's not subject to the statute of frauds, and a conflicting oral agreement that is subject to the statute of frauds. In that case, the one agreement is enforceable, the other agreement is not. It has nothing to do with the LLC Act. Now, in our view, the maximum effect language means what the court said it meant in Alf Adekam. Where the court said, the basic approach of the Delaware Act is to provide members with broad discretion in drafting the agreement and to furnish default provisions when the member's agreement is silent. Specifically in talking about the maximum effect provision, the court quoted a treatise by Lubaroff and Altman. The Act's basic approach is to permit partners to have the broadest possible discretion in drafting their partnership agreements, and to furnish answers only in situations where the partners have not expressly made provisions in their partnership agreement. This language focuses on the substantive arrangements among the partners. Now, appellant contends that the maximum effect language constitutes an implied repeal of the statute of frauds as applied to LLC Act. Our view is that it's perfectly possible to reconcile those two provisions by taking the Alf Adekun approach, which is that the maximum effect provision means that, for example, you can do away with fiduciary duties. You can make other, whatever arrangements you make are all right. Now, if you go to, and that's what we think the word enforceability means. We think that's talking about the enforceability of the substantive terms of the agreement among the partners in a limited partnership or the members of an LLC.
So if I understand your position correctly, it is that the maximum effect language, and indeed the statute, presupposes an enforceable contract.
Right, it's right.
And that body of law and rules that governs whether or not a contract is enforceable is simply not reached by any language of the LLC statute.
Exactly. And I think there's not the slightest bit of evidence that the legislature ever thought about the statute of frauds in adopting the maximum effect language. Now, if under the broader extreme view of what the maximum effect language means that's being put to you by the appellant, if enforceability refers to stripping away the traditional limitations on proving the existence of an agreement, does that mean that the hearsay rule would be inapplicable in a contract case because it stands in the way of proving the existence of an agreement? Would you lower the burden of proof for the proponent of the existence of an agreement? What about agreements with minors? Does the statute really mean that an agreement that a minor can be bound to an LLC agreement, even though I assume the law of Delaware, like most places, does not allow a minor to be bound to a contract, even though he or she may have signed it. So maximum effect simply does not mean anything goes. It means that the members of an LLC, in structuring the LLC, can determine the terms of their relationship.
Let's explore for just a minute another construct of the language about oral agreements, oral LLC agreements. At the time the LLC statute passed, the legislature was, of course, aware that there was just for the flight of fancy of assuming that the legislature knows what it's doing when it passes mm-hmm. a statute. Let's assume that they were aware that the statute of frauds existed and could have dealt with this issue that's before us today, whether it's case dispositive or not, something we probably should explore dealing with. There's no mention of the statute of frauds or any interplay between the two statutes.
Right.
Why don't we simply look at the language at face value and say all oral agreements are enforceable because in the LLC statute they didn't say they were not?
Well, I think that
it's a brighter line rule. It's easier to apply in the absence of evidence of fraud.
I don't think that's the rule on implied repeal. What you're suggesting is that you should assume a repeal of another statute is implied in a particular statute if the legislature doesn't say they're not repealing it. But the rule is that they have to say or act in a way that makes it impossible to reconcile the two or that expressly repeals the other statute. So the presumption is that they were aware of the statute of frauds and they did not intend. And they don't say that all oral agreements are enforceable. They say that agreements for an LLC may be written oral or implied. Just like any other agreement may be written oral or implied, that's true of a contract for the sale of personalty, for example, which is not subject to the statute of frauds. But that doesn't mean that the statute of frauds is inapplicable to other provisions where it applies. It's just like any other contract.
No, I understand your argument. I'm just, in my own mind, trying to turn over the concept that the LLC statute is supposed to be liberally construed, and at the time that they passed the statute that said LLC agreements may be oral, that's, in some people's mind, extraordinary because it makes it more difficult for proof of the existence of an agreement and more likely to stimulate disputes. But did they have the statute of frauds in mind, and what did they think should be the interplay between the two?
Well, you
made your argument very clear.
Yeah, I think you can only indulge the traditional presumption on implied repeal, in our view. Now, let me just say a couple of words about the multiple writings or memorandum exception to the statute of frauds, which is the last point I want to cover. Crabtree is the seminal case, we agree. Crabtree requires that the signed writing refer to the same subject matter or transaction as the agreement that it's offered in evidence to establish. The liquidation agreement was about the liquidation of the various Viking entities. It was not about the same subject matter. So for that reason, it does not pass the Crabtree test. Now, Crabtree was a case in which the signed writing made no reference to the contract, the alleged contract. But what it did do was it recited virtually every term of the contract except the duration of the employment. And in fact, if you look at the cases that are cited to you, you will not find a single case where there is so little reference to the terms of the alleged contract in the writing that's offered as a memorandum. This was not a memorandum of the draft founders agreement. Even if it referred to it, and it sheds no light on the terms of the draft founders agreement. So under the circumstances, and I'll give back my last 35 seconds, the multiple writings exception is not satisfied here. Thank your honors.
Thank you, counsel.
The position advanced here is that maximum effect of the enforceability of LLC agreements does not mean what it says. Because clearly, under the other side's view of the statute of frauds will apply in certain circumstances to oral agreements. That is contrary to the language of the statute, and they are irreconcilable. Under the C versus C case, this court has made clear that the latest statute, and obviously the one that is most specific to the subject matter, is the one that prevails over the earlier enacted statute. Under both the Vice Chancellor's reading and under Appellee's reading here, the statute does not mean what it plainly says, and the word maximum has been stripped of its meaning. The standard of error here, Justice Jacobs, is not clear error, but it's whether the evidence that was not considered would go to the heart of the dispute. And plainly here, although the evidence was admitted, and I understand from my Delaware colleagues that it is standard practice in the Court of Chancery to allow the evidence in so that the Vice Chancellor can then determine what would be subject to applicable rules or not.
I'm sorry, has anyone suggested that the standard is clear error?
I think that's the upshot of the argument on the other side where he says that it was harmless error. His point, I submit, is one as to whether or not, based on looking at the evidence, there was a sufficient error that would allow you to affirm, notwithstanding the legal errors that were committed in our view by the Vice Chancellor. So when the Vice Chancellor makes the comment about overwhelming evidence, it has to be viewed through the lens of what was not being considered because of the statute of frauds ruling. Here, the liquidation agreement was about the operating agreements of the LLCs that had been formed by the three founders, one of which was the founders agreement. So we submit it's incorrect to say that it is not about the subject matter of the founders agreement. The whole purpose of the liquidation agreement was what to do about the existing operating agreements of these other LLCs that had been formed, one of which was the founders agreement. And there is equity that is being funneled through the founders mechanism so that the three founders would be treated differently than all of the other employees of the hedge fund who were getting capital and compensation. The founders received additional income on an annual basis, and they had built up equity to the point where, in 2007, this enterprise had $10 billion under assets and had revenue of $650 million. Now, it is not credible to say that that kind of ongoing enterprise has no equity. And yet that is the fundamental proposition the other side would like to convince you, that these founders who intended to create an ongoing enterprise created something that had no equity. They are, after all, equity specialists. That's how they make their money, by knowing what equity is. And after the February 1999 first agreement, where they sat down to organize this enterprise, they came to the realization that they had additional equity that should be treated. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Counsel. This may not be said in every jurisdiction, but let me say, I at least, and I'm sure the entire panel, found this to be not only an interesting but even an intriguing argument that was extraordinarily well presented, and I thank you for that. We'll recess and take the case under advisement.